After the mysterious interview in the Four Chains, the one so abruptly ended there by Billy, nothing especially germane to the story occurred until the events now about to be narrated. Elsewhere it has been said that owing to the lack of frigates, of course better sailors than line-of-battleships, in the English squadron up the Straits at that period, the indomitable 74 was occasionally employed not only as an available substitute for a scout, but at times on detached service of more important kind. This was not alone because of her sailing qualities, not common in a ship of her rate, but quite as much probably that the character of her commander, it was thought, especially adapted him for any duty where, under unforeseen difficulties, a prompt initiative might have to be taken in some matter demanding knowledge and ability, in addition to those qualities employed in good seamanship. It was on an expedition of the latter sort, a somewhat distant one, and when the Indomitable was almost at her furthest remove from the fleet, that in the latter part of an afternoon watch she unexpectedly came in sight of a ship of the enemy. It proved to be a frigate. The latter, perceiving through the glass that the weight of men and metal would be heavily against her, invoking her light heels, crowded sail to get away. After a chase urged almost against hope, and lasting until about the middle of the first dog watch, she signally succeeded in effecting her escape. Not long after the pursuit had been given up, and ere the excitement incident thereto had altogether waned away, the master-at-arms, ascending from his cavernous sphere, made his appearance, cap in hand, by the mainmast, respectfully waiting the notice of Captain Vere, then solitary, walking the weather side of the quarter-deck, doubtless somewhat chafed at the failure of the pursuit. The spot where Claggett stood was the place allotted to men of lesser grades, seeking some more particular interview either with the officer of the deck or the captain himself. But from the latter it was not often that a sailor or petty officer of those days would seek a hearing. Only some exceptional cause would, according to established custom, have warranted that. Presently, just as the commander, absorbed in his reflections, was on the point of turning aft in his promenade, he became sensible of Claggart's presence, and saw the doffed cap held in deferential expectancy. Here be it said that Captain Vere's personal knowledge of this petty officer had only begun at the time of the ship's last sailing from home, Claggart then, for the first time in transfer from a ship detained for repairs, supplying on board the Indomitable the place of a previous master-at-arms, disabled and ashore. No sooner did the commander observe who it was that now so deferentially stood awaiting his notice than a peculiar expression came over his face. It was not unlike that which uncontrollably will flit across the countenance of one at unawares encountering a person who, though known to him, indeed has hardly been long enough known for thorough knowledge, but something in whose aspect, nevertheless now for the first, provokes a vaguely repellent distaste. But coming to a stand and resuming much of his wonted official manner, save that a sort of impatience lurked in the intonation of the opening word, he said, "Well, what is it, Master-at-Arms?" With the air of a subordinate grieved at the necessity of being a messenger of ill tidings, and while conscientiously determined to be frank, yet equally resolved upon shunning overstatement, Claggart, at this invitation, or rather summons to disburthen, spoke up. What he said, conveyed in the language of no uneducated man, was to the effect following, if not altogether in these words, namely, that during the chase and preparations for the possible encounter, he had seen enough to convince him that at least one sailor aboard was a dangerous character in a ship mustering some who not only had taken a guilty part in the late serious trouble, but others also who, like the man in question, had entered His Majesty's service under another form than enlistment. At this point, Captain Vere, with some impatience, interrupted him. "Be direct, man. Say impressed men." Claggart made a gesture of subservience and proceeded. Quite lately, he, Claggart, had begun to suspect that some sort of movement, prompted by the sailor in question, was covertly going on, but he had not thought himself warranted in reporting the suspicion so long as it remained indistinct. But from what he had that afternoon observed in the man referred to, the suspicion of something clandestine going on had advanced to a point less removed from certainty. He deeply felt, he added, the serious responsibility assumed in making a report involving such possible consequences to the individual mainly concerned, besides tending to augment those natural anxieties which every naval commander must feel in view of extraordinary outbreaks so recent as those which, he sorrowfully said it needed not to name. Now, at the first broaching of the matter, Captain Vere, taken by surprise, could not wholly dissemble his disquietude. But as Claggett went on, the former's aspect changed into restiveness, under something in the testifier's manner in giving his testimony. However, he refrained from interrupting him, and Claggett, continuing, concluded with this. "God forbid, Your Honor, that the indomitable should be the experience of the—" "Never mind that!" Here peremptorily broke in the superior, his face altering with anger instantly, divining the ship that the other was about to name, one in which the Nore mutiny had assumed a singularly tragical character that for a time jeopardized the life of its commander. Under the circumstances, he was indignant at the purposed allusion. When the commissioned officers themselves were on all occasions very heedful how they referred to the recent event, for a petty officer unnecessarily to allude to it in the presence of his captain, this struck him as a most immodest presumption. Besides, to his quick sense of self-respect, it even looked under the circumstances something like an attempt to alarm him. Nor, at that, was he without some surprise that one who, so far as he had hitherto come under his notice, had shown considerable tact in his function, should in this particular evince such lack of it. But these thoughts and kindred dubious ones flitting across his mind were suddenly replaced by an intuitional surmise, which, though as yet obscure in form, served practically to affect his reception of the ill tidings. Certain it is that, long versed in everything pertaining to the complicated gun-deck life, which, like every other form of life, has its secret minds and dubious sides, the side popularly disclaimed, Captain Vere did not permit himself to be unduly disturbed by the general tenor of his subordinate's report. Furthermore, if in view of recent events prompt action should be taken at the first palpable sign of recurring insubordination, for all that, not judicious would it be, he thought, to keep the idea of lingering disaffection alive by undue forwardness in crediting an informer, even if his own subordinate, and charged among others with police surveillance of the crew. This feeling would not, perhaps, have so prevailed with him, were it not that upon a prior occasion the patriotic zeal officially evinced by Claggett had somewhat irritated him as appearing rather supersensitive and strained. Furthermore, something even in the official's self-possessed and somewhat ostentatious manner in making his specifications strangely reminded him of a bandsman, a perjured witness in a capital case before a court-martial ashore, of which when a lieutenant he, Captain Vere, had been a member. Now the peremptory check given to Claggett in the matter of the arrested illusion was quickly followed up by this. You say that there is at least one dangerous man aboard. Name him.
William Budd, a foretopman, Your Honor.
William Budd, repeated Captain Vere with unfeigned astonishment. And mean you the man that Lieutenant Ratcliffe took from the merchantman not very long ago? The young fellow who seems to be so popular with the men, Billy, the handsome sailor, as they call him?
The same, Your Honor. But for all his youth and good looks, a deep one. Not for nothing does he insinuate himself into the goodwill of his shipmates, since at the least they will at a pinch say a good word for him at all hazards. Did Lieutenant Ratcliffe happen to tell Your Honor of that adroit fling of Bud's jumping up in the cutter's bow under the merchantman's stern when he was being taken off? That sort of good-humored air even masks that at heart he resents his impressment. Yeah, but noted his fair cheek, a man-trap may be under his ruddy-tipped daisies.
Now, the handsome sailor, as a signal figure among the crew, had naturally enough attracted the captain's attention from the first. Though in general not very demonstrative to his officers, he had congratulated Lieutenant Ratcliffe upon his good fortune in lighting on such a fine specimen of the genus Homo, who in the nude might have passed for a statue of young Adam before the fall. As to Billy's adieu to the ship Rights of Man, which the boarding lieutenant, in a deferential way, had indeed reported to him, Captain Vere, more as a good story than aught else, having mistakenly understood it as a satiric sally, had but thought so much the better of the impressed man for it, as a military sailor, admiring the spirit that could take an arbitrary enlistment so merrily and sensibly. The foretopman's conduct, too, so far as it had fallen under the captain's notice, had confirmed the first happy augury, while the new recruit's qualities as a sailor-man seemed to be such that he had thought of recommending him to the executive officer for a promotion to a place that would more frequently bring him under his own observation, namely the captaincy of the mizzen-top, replacing there in the starboard watch a man not so young, whom partly for that reason he deemed less fitted for the post. Be it parenthesized here that since the mizzen topmen have not to handle such breadths of heavy canvas at the lower sails on the mainmast and foremast, a young man, if of the right stuff, not only seems best adapted to duty there, but, in fact, is generally selected for the captaincy of that top, and the company under him are light hands, and often but striplings. In sum, Captain Vere had from the beginning deemed Billy Budd to be what in the naval parlance of the time was called a king's bargain. That is to say, for His Britannic Majesty's Navy, a capital investment at small outlay, or none at all. After a brief pause, during which the reminiscences above mentioned passed vividly through his mind, he weighed the import of Claggett's last suggestion conveyed in the phrase, "a man-trap under his ruddy-tipped daisies." And the more he weighed it, the less reliance he felt in the informer's good faith. Suddenly he turned upon him. "Do you come to me, master-at-arms, with so foggy a tale? As to Bud, cite me an act or spoken word of his, confirmatory of what you in general charge against him. Stay," drawing nearer to him, "heed what you speak. Just now, and in a case like this, there is a yard-arm end for the false witness."
"Ah, your honor," sighed Claggett, mildly shaking his shapely head, as in sad deprecation of such unmerited severity of tone. Then bridling, erecting himself as in virtuous self-assertion, he circumstantially alleged certain words and acts which collectively, if credited, led to presumptions mortally inculpating Bud, and for some of these averments, he added, substantiating proof was not far. With gray eyes impatient and distrustful, essaying to fathom to the bottom Claggett's calm violet ones, Captain Vere again heard him out, then for the moment stood ruminating. Claggett, himself for the time liberated from the other's scrutiny, steadily regarded Captain Vere with a look difficult to render, a look curious of the operation of his tactics, a look such as might have been that of the spokesman of the envious children of Jacob, deceptively imposing upon the troubled patriarch the blood-dyed coat of young Joseph. Though something exceptional in the moral quality of Captain Vere made him, in earnest encounter with a fellow man, a veritable touchstone of that man's essential nature, yet now, as to Claggett and what was really going on in him, his feeling partook less of intuitional conviction than of strong suspicion clogged by strange dubieties. The perplexity he evinced proceeded less from aught touching the man informed against, as Claggett doubtless opined, than from considerations how best to act in regard to the informer. At first, indeed, he was naturally for summoning that substantiation of his allegations which Claggett said was at hand. But such a proceeding would result in the matter at once getting abroad, which, in the present stage of it, he thought might undesirably affect the ship's company. If Claggett was a false witness, that closed the affair. And therefore, before trying the accusation, he would first practically test the accuser, and he thought this could be done in a quiet, undemonstrative way. The measure he determined upon involved a shifting of the scene, a transfer to a place less exposed to observation than the broad quarter-deck. For although the few gun-room officers there at the time had, in due observance of naval etiquette, withdrawn to leeward the moment Captain Vere had begun his promenade on the deck's weather side, and though, during the colloquy with Claggett, they, of course, ventured not to diminish the distance, and though, throughout the interview, Captain Vere's voice was far from high and Claggett's silvery and low, and the wind in the cordage and the wash of the sea helped the more to put them beyond earshot, nevertheless the interviewer's continuance already had attracted observation from some topmen aloft, and other sailors in the waist or farther forward. Having determined upon his measures, Captain Vere forthwith took action. Abruptly turning to Claggett, he asked, "Master-at-arms, is it now Bud's watch aloft?" "No, Your Honor."
Whereupon, "Mr. Wilkes," summoning the nearest midshipman, "tell Albert to come to me." Albert was the captain's hammock boy, a sort of sea valet, in whose discretion and fidelity his master had much confidence. The lad appeared. "You know Bud, the foretopman?"
"I do, sir."
"Go find him. It is his watch off. Manage to tell him out of earshot that he is wanted aft. Contrive it that he speaks to nobody. Keep him in talk yourself. And not till you get well aft here, not till then, let him know that the place where he is wanted is my cabin. You understand? Go. Master-at-arms, show yourself on the decks below, and when you think it time for Albert to be coming with his man, stand by quietly to follow the sailor in." Now, when the foretopman found himself closeted, as it were, in the cabin with the captain and Claggart, he was surprised enough. But it was a surprise unaccompanied by apprehension or distrust. To an immature nature, essentially honest and humane, forewarning intimations of subtler danger from one's kind came tardily, if at all. The only thing that took shape in the young sailor's mind was this. Yes, the captain, I've always thought, looks kindly upon me. Wonder if he's going to make me his coxswain. I should like that. And maybe now he's going to ask the master-at-arms about me.
Shut the door there, sentry, said the commander. Stand without and let nobody come in. Now, master-at-arms, tell this man to his face what you told of him to me, and stood prepared to scrutinize the mutually confronting visages.
With the measured step and calm, collected air of an asylum physician approaching in the public hall some patient beginning to show indications of a coming paroxysm, Claggart deliberately advanced within short range of Billy, and mesmerically looking him in the eye, briefly recapitulated the accusation. Not at first did Billy take it in. When he did, the rose tan of his cheek looked struck as by white leprosy. He stood like one impaled and gagged. Meanwhile, the accuser's eyes, removing not as yet from the blue, dilated ones, underwent a phenomenal change, their wonted rich violet color blurring into a muddy purple. Those lights of human intelligence losing human expression, gelidly protruding like the alien eyes of certain uncatalogued creatures of the deep. The first mesmeric glance was one of surprised fascination. The last was as the hungry lurch of the torpedo fish. "Speak, man," said Captain Vere to the transfixed one, struck by his aspect even more than by Claggart's. "Speak, defend yourself." Which appeal caused but a strange, dumb gesturing and gurgling in Billy, amazement at such an accusation so suddenly sprung on inexperienced non-age. This, and it may be the horror at the accuser, serving to bring out his lurking defect, and in this instance for the time intensifying it into a convulsed tongue-tie, while the intent head and entire form, straining forward in an agony of ineffectual eagerness to obey the injunction to speak and defend himself, gave an expression to the face like that of a condemned vestal priestess in the moment of being buried alive and in the first struggle against suffocation. Though at the time Captain Vere was quite ignorant of Billy's liability to vocal impediment, he now immediately divined it, since vividly Billy's aspect recalled to him that of a bright young schoolmate of his whom he had seen struck by much the same startling impotence in the act of eagerly rising in the class to be foremost in response to a testing question put to it by the master. Going close up to the young sailor and laying a soothing hand on his shoulder, he said, "There is no hurry, my boy. Take your time, take your time." Contrary to the effect intended, these words, so fatherly in tone, doubtless touching Billy's heart to the quick, prompted yet more violent efforts at utterance, efforts soon ending for the time in confirming the paralysis, and bringing to the face an expression which was as a crucifixion to behold. The next instant, quick as the flame from a discharged cannon at night, his right arm shot out, and Claggart dropped to the deck. Whether intentionally, or but owing to the young athlete's superior height, the blow had taken effect full upon the forehead, so shapely and intellectual-looking a feature in the master-at-arms, so that the body fell over lengthwise, like a heavy plank tilted from erectness. A gasp or two, and he lay motionless.
"Fated boy," breathed Captain Vere, in tone so low as to be almost a whisper. "What have you done? But here, help me."
The twain raised the felled one from the loins up into a sitting position. The spare form flexibly acquiesced, but inertly. It was handling like a dead snake. They lowered it back. Regaining erectness, Captain Vere, with one hand covering his face, stood to all appearance as impassive as the object at his feet. Was he absorbed in taking in all the bearings of the event, and what was best, not only now at once to be done, but also in the sequel? Slowly he uncovered his face, and the effect was as if the moon emerging from eclipse should reappear with quite another aspect
than that which had gone into hiding. The father in him, manifested towards Billy thus far in the scene, was replaced by the military disciplinarian. In his official tone, he bade the foretopman retire to his stateroom aft, pointing it out, and there remain till thence summoned. This order Billy, in silence, mechanically obeyed. Then, going to the cabin door where it opened on the quarterdeck, Captain Vere said to the sentry without, "Tell somebody to send Albert here." When the lad appeared, his master so contrived it that he should not catch sight of the prone one. "Albert," he said to him, "tell the surgeon I wish to see him. You need not come back till called." When the surgeon entered, a self-poised character of that grave sense and experience that hardly anything could take him aback, Captain Vere advanced to meet him, thus unconsciously interrupting his view of Claggett, and interrupting the other's wonted unceremonious salutation, said, "Nay, tell me how it is with yonder man," directing his attention to the prostrate one. The surgeon looked, and for all his self-command, somewhat startled at the abrupt revelation. On Claggett's always pallid complexion, thick black blood was now oozing from mouth and ear. To the gazer's professional eyes, it was unmistakably no living man that he saw. "Is it so, then?" said Captain Vere, intently watching him. "I thought it, but verify it." Whereupon the customary tests confirmed the surgeon's first glance, who now, looking up in unfeigned concern, cast a look of intense inquisitiveness upon his superior. But Captain Vere, with one hand to his brow, was standing motionless. Suddenly catching the surgeon's arm, convulsively he exclaimed, pointing down to the body, "It is the divine judgment of Ananias! Look!" Disturbed by the excited manner he had never before observed in the Indomitable's captain, and as yet wholly ignorant of the affair, the prudent surgeon nevertheless held his peace, only again looking in earnest interrogation as to what it was that had resulted in such a tragedy. But Captain Vere was now again motionless, standing, absorbed in thought. But again starting, he vehemently exclaimed, "Struck dead by an angel of God! Yet the angel must hang!" At these interjections, incoherences to the listener as yet unapprised of the antecedent events, the surgeon was profoundly discomforted. But now, as recollecting himself, Captain Vere, in less harsh tone, briefly related the circumstances leading up to the event. "But come, we must dispatch," he added. "Help me to remove him," meaning the body, "to yonder compartment," designating one opposite where the foretopman remained immured. Anew disturbed by a request that, as implying a desire for secrecy, seemed unaccountably strange to him, there was nothing for the subordinate to do but comply. "Go now," said Captain Vere, with something of his wonted manner. "Go now. I shall presently call at Drumhead Court. Tell the lieutenants what has happened, and tell Mr. Morton," meaning the captain of marines, "and charge them to keep the matter to themselves." Full of disquietude and misgivings, the surgeon left the cabin. Was Captain Vere suddenly affected in his mind, or was it but a transient excitement brought about by so strange and extraordinary a happening? As to the Drumhead Court, it struck the surgeon as impolitic, if nothing more. The thing to do, he thought, was to place Billy Budd in confinement, and, in a way dictated by usage, and postpone further action in so extraordinary a case to such time as they should again join the squadron and then transfer it to the Admiral. He recalled the unwonted agitation of Captain Vere and his excited exclamations, so at variance with his normal manner. Was he unhinged? But assuming that he was, it were not so susceptible of proof. What then could he do? No more trying situation is conceivable than that of an officer subordinated under a captain whom he suspects to be not mad indeed, but yet not quite unaffected in his intellect. To argue his order to him would be insolence. To resist him would be mutiny. In obedience to Captain Vere, he communicated to the lieutenants and captain of marines what had happened, saying nothing more as to the captain's state. They stared at him in surprise and concern. Like him, they seemed to think that such a matter should be reported to the admiral. Who in the rainbow can draw the line where the violet tint ends and the orange tint begins? Distinctly we see the difference of the color, but where exactly does the first one visibly enter into the other? So with sanity and insanity. In pronounced cases, there is no question about them, but in some cases, in various degrees, supposedly less pronounced,
To draw the line of demarcation few will undertake, though for a fee some professional experts will. There is nothing nameable but that some men will undertake to do for pay. In other words, there are instances where it is next to impossible to determine whether a man is sane or beginning to be otherwise. Whether Captain Vere, as the surgeon professionally surmised, was really the sudden victim of any degree of aberration, one must determine for himself by such light as this narrative may afford. The unhappy event, which has been narrated, could not have happened at a worse juncture, for it was close on the heel of the suppressed insurrections, an aftertime very critical to naval authority, demanding from every English sea commander two qualities not readily interfusible, prudence and rigor. Moreover, there was something crucial in the case. In the jugglery of circumstances preceding and attending the event on board the Indomitable, and in the light of that martial code whereby it was formally to be judged, innocence and guilt, personified in Claggart and Budd, in effect changed places. In the legal view, the apparent victim of the tragedy was he who had sought to victimize a man blameless, and the indisputable deed of the latter, navally regarded, constituted the most heinous of military crimes. Yet more. The essential right and wrong involved in the matter, the clearer that might be, so much the worse for the responsibility of a loyal sea commander, inasmuch as he was authorized to determine the matter on that primitive legal basis. Small wonder, then, that the Indomitable's captain, though in general a man of rigid decision, felt that circumspectness not less than promptitude was necessary. Until he could decide upon his course, and in each detail, and not only so, but until the concluding measure was upon the point of being enacted, he deemed it advisable, in view of all the circumstances, to guard as much as possible against publicity. Here he may or may not have erred. Certain it is, however, that subsequently, in the confidential talk of more than one or two gunrooms and cabins, he was not a little criticized by some officers, a fact imputed by his friends, and vehemently by his cousin Jack Denton, to professional jealousy of Starry Vere. Some imaginative ground for invidious comment there was. The maintenance of secrecy in the matter, the confining all knowledge of it for a time to the place where the homicide occurred, the quarter-deck cabin, in these particulars lurked some resemblance to the policy adopted in those tragedies of the palace which have occurred more than once in the capital founded by Peter the Barbarian, great chiefly by his crimes. The case was such that fain would the Indomitable's captain have deferred taking any action whatever respecting it further than to keep the foretopman a close prisoner till the ship rejoined the squadron, and then submitting the matter to the judgment of his admiral. But a true military officer is in one particular like a true monk. Not with more of self-abnegation will the latter keep his vows of monastic obedience than the former his vows of allegiance to martial duty. Feeling that unless quick action was taken on it, the deed of the foretopman, as soon as it should be known on the gun decks, would tend to awaken any slumbering embers of the gnaw among the crew, a sense of the urgency of the case overruled in Captain Vere every other consideration. But though a conscientious disciplinarian, he was no lover of authority for mere authority's sake. Very far was he from embracing opportunities for monopolizing to himself the perils of moral responsibility, none at least that could properly be referred to an official superior, or shared with him by his official equals or even subordinates. So thinking, he was glad it would not be at variance with usage to turn the matter over to a summary court of his own officers, reserving to himself, as the one on whom the ultimate accountability would rest, the right of maintaining a supervision of it, or formally or informally interposing at need. Accordingly, a drumhead court was summarily convened, he electing the individuals composing it, the first lieutenant, the captain of marines, and the sailing master. In associating an officer of marines with the sea lieutenant in a case having to do with a sailor, the commander perhaps deviated from general custom. He was prompted thereto by the circumstances that he took that soldier to be a judicious person, thoughtful, and not altogether incapable of grappling with a difficult case unprecedented in his prior experience. Yet even as to him he was not without some latent misgiving, for withal he was an extremely good-natured man, an enjoyer of his dinner, a sound sleeper, and inclined to obesity, The sort of man who, though he would always maintain his manhood in battle, might not prove altogether reliable in a moral dilemma involving aught of the tragic. As to the first lieutenant and the sailing master, Captain Vere could not but be aware that, though honest natures, of approved gallantry upon occasion, their intelligence was mostly confined to the matter of active seamanship and the fighting demands of their profession. The court was held in the same cabin where the unfortunate affair had taken place. This cabin, the commander's, embraced the entire area under the poop deck. Aft and on either side was a small stateroom, the one room temporarily a jail, and the other a deadhouse, and a yet smaller compartment leaving a space between, expanding forward into a goodly oblong of length coinciding with the ship's beam. A skylight of moderate dimensions was overhead, and at each end of the oblong space were two sashed porthole windows, easily convertible back into embrasures for short carronades. All being quickly in readiness, Billy Budd was arraigned, Captain Vere necessarily appearing as the sole witness in the case, and as such temporarily sinking his rank, though singularly maintaining it in a matter apparently trivial, namely that he testified from the ship's weather side, with that object having caused the court to sit on the lee side. Concisely, he narrated all that had led up to the catastrophe, omitting nothing in Claggart's accusation, and deposing as to the manner in which the prisoner had received it. At this testimony, the three officers glanced with no little surprise at Billy Budd, the last man they would have suspected either of mutinous design alleged by Claggart, or of the undeniable deed he himself had done. The first lieutenant, taking judicial primary and turning toward the prisoner, said, "Captain Vere has spoken. Is it or is it not as Captain Vere says?" In response came syllables not so much impeded in the utterances as might have been anticipated. They were these: "Captain Vere tells the truth. It is just as Captain Vere says, but it is not as the master-at-arms said. I have eaten the king's bread, and I am true to the king."
"I believe you, my man," said the witness, his voice indicating a suppressed emotion not otherwise betrayed.
"God will bless you for that, Your Honor."
"Not without stammering," said Billy, and all but broke down, but immediately was recalled to self-control by another question, to which, with the same emotional difficulty of utterance, he said,
"No, there was no malice between us. I never bore malice against the master-at-arms. I am sorry that he is dead. I did not mean to kill him. Could I have used my tongue, I would not have struck him, but he foully lied to my face, and in the presence of my captain, and I had to say something, and I could only say it with a blow. God help me."
In the impulsive, above-board manner of the frank one, the court saw confirmed all that was implied in words that just previously had perplexed them, coming as they did from the testifier to the tragedy, and promptly following Billy's impassioned disclaimer of mutinous intent, Captain Vere's words, "I believe you, my man." Next, it was asked of him whether he knew of or suspected aught savoring of incipient trouble, meaning mutiny, though the explicit term was avoided, going on in any section of the ship's company. The reply lingered. This was naturally imputed by the court to the same vocal embarrassment which had retarded or obstructed previous answers. But in main it was otherwise here, the question immediately recalling to Billy's mind the interview with the afterguardsman in the forechains. But an innate repugnance to playing a part at all approaching that of an informer against one's own shipmates, the same erring sense of uninstructed honor which had stood in the way of his reporting the matter at the time, though as a loyal man-of-war's man it was incumbent on him, and failure so to do it charged against him and proven would have subjected him to the heaviest of penalties. This, with the blind feeling now his that nothing really was being hatched, prevailed with him. When the answer came, it was a negative. "One question more," said the officer of marines, now first speaking, and with a troubled earnestness. "You tell us that what the master-at-arms said against you was a lie. Now why should he have so lied, so maliciously lied, since you declare there was no malice between you?" At that question, unintentionally touching on a spiritual sphere, wholly obscure to Billy's thoughts, he was nonplussed, evincing a confusion, indeed, that some observers, such as can be imagined, would have construed into involuntary evidence of hidden guilt. Nevertheless, he strove some way to answer.
but all at once relinquished the vain endeavor, at the same time turning an appealing glance towards Captain Vere, as deeming him his best helper and friend. Captain Vere, who had been seated for a time, rose to his feet, addressing the interrogator.
"The question you put to him comes naturally enough, but how can he rightly answer it, or anybody else? Unless indeed it be he who lies within there," designating the compartment where lay the corpse. "But the prone one there will not rise to our summons. In effect, though, as it seems to me, the point you make is hardly material. Quite aside from any conceivable motive actuating the master-at-arms, and irrespective of the provocation of the blow, a martial court must needs, in the present case, confine its attention to the blow's consequence, which consequence is to be deemed not otherwise than as the striker's deed." This utterance, the full significance of which it was not at all likely that Billy took in, nevertheless caused him to turn a wistful, interrogative look toward the speaker, a look in its dumb expressiveness not unlike that which a dog of generous breed might turn upon his master, seeking in his face some elucidation of a previous gesture ambiguous to the canine intelligence. Nor was the same utterance without marked effect upon the three officers, more especially the soldier. Couched in it seemed to them a meaning unanticipated, involving a prejudgment on the speaker's part. It served to augment a mental disturbance previously evident enough. The soldier spoke once more, in a tone of suggestive dubiety, addressing at once his associates and Captain Vere. "Nobody is present, none of the ship's company, I mean, who might shed lateral light, if any is to be had, upon what remains mysterious in this matter." "That is thoughtfully put," said Captain Vere. "I see your drift. Aye, that is a mystery. But to use a scriptural phrase, it is a mystery of iniquity, a matter for psychological theologians to discuss. But what has a military court to do with it? Not to add that for us, any possible investigation of it is cut off by the lasting tongue-tie, him in yonder," again designating the mortuary stateroom. "The prisoner's deed. With that alone we have to do." To this, particularly the closing reiteration, the marine soldier, knowing not how aptly to reply, sadly abstained from saying aught. The first lieutenant, who at the outset had not unnaturally assumed primacy in the court, now overrulingly instructed by a glance from Captain Vere, a glance more effective than words, resumed that primacy. Turning to the prisoner, "Bud," he said in scarce an equable tones, "Bud, if you have aught further to say for yourself, say it now." Upon this the young sailor turned another quick glance toward Captain Vere. Then, as taking a hint from that aspect, a hint confirming his own instinct that silence was now best, replied to the lieutenant, "I have said all, sir." The marine, the same who had been the sentinel without the cabin door at the time that the fore topman, followed by the master-at-arms, entered it, he, standing by the sailor throughout their judicial proceedings, was now directed to take him back to the after-compartment originally assigned to the prisoner and his custodian. As the twain disappeared from view, the three officers, as partially liberated from some inward constraint associated with Billy's mere presence, simultaneously stirred in their seats. They exchanged looks of troubled indecision, yet feeling that decide they must, and without long delay, for Captain Vere was for the time sitting unconsciously with his back toward them, apparently in one of his absent fits, gazing out from a sashed porthole to windward upon the monotonous blank of the twilight sea. But the court's silence continuing, broken only at moments by brief consultations in low, earnest tones, this seemed to assure him and encourage him. Turning, he to and fro paced the cabin athwart, in the returning ascent to windward climbing the slant deck in the ship's lee roll, without knowing it symbolizing thus in his action a mind resolute to surmount difficulties, even if against primitive instincts strong as the wind and the sea. Presently he came to a stand before the three. After scanning their faces, he stood less as mustering his thoughts for expression than as one only deliberating how best to put them to well-meaning men not intellectually mature, men with whom it was necessary to demonstrate certain principles that were axioms to himself. Similar impatience as to talking is perhaps one reason that deters some minds from addressing any popular assemblies, under which head is to be classed most legislatures in a democracy. When speak he did, something both in the substance of what he said and his manner of saying it showed the influence of unshared studies modifying and tempering the practical training of an active career.
This, along with his phraseology now and then, was suggestive of the grounds whereon rested that imputation of a certain pedantry socially alleged against him by certain naval men of wholly practical cast, captains who nevertheless would frankly concede that His Majesty's Navy mustered no more efficient officers of their grade than Starry Veer. What he said was to this effect: "Hitherto I have been but the witness, little more. And I should hardly think now to take another tone, that of your co-adjutor for the time. Did I not perceive in you, at the crisis, too, a troubled hesitancy, proceeding, I doubt not, from the clashing of military duty with moral scruple, scruple vitalized by compassion? For the compassion, how can I otherwise but share it? But mindful of paramount obligation, I strive against scruples that may tend to enervate decision. Not, gentlemen, that I hide from myself that the case is an exceptional one. Speculatively regarded, it might well be referred to a jury of casuists. But for us here, acting not as casuists or moralists, it is a case practical and under martial law practically to be dealt with. But your scruples, do they move as in a dusk? Challenge them. Make them advance and declare themselves. Come now, do they impart something like this? If, mindless of palliating circumstances, we are bound to regard the death of the master-at-arms as the prisoner's deed, then does that deed constitute a capital crime whereof the penalty is a mortal one? But, in natural justice, is nothing but the prisoner's overt act to be considered? Now, can we adjudge to summary and shameful death a fellow creature innocent before God and whom we feel to be so? Does that state it aright? You sign sad assent. Well, I too feel that, the full force of that. It is nature. But do these buttons that we wear attest that our allegiance is to nature? No, to the king. Though the ocean, which is inviolate, nature primeval, though this be the element where we move and have our being as sailors, yet, as the king's officers, lies our duty in a sphere correspondingly natural. So little is that true, that in receiving our commissions we, in the most important regards, ceased to be natural free agents. When war is declared, are we the commissioned fighters previously consulted? We fight at command. If our judgments approve the war, that is but coincidence. So in other particulars. So now, would it be so much we ourselves that would condemn, as it would be martial law operating through us? For that law and the rigor of it, we are not responsible. Our vowed responsibility is in this, that however pitilessly that law may operate, we nevertheless adhere to it and administer it. But the exceptional in the matter moves the heart within you. Even so, too, is mine moved. But let not warm hearts betray heads that should be cool. Ashore in a criminal case, will an upright judge allow himself off the bench to be waylaid by some tender kinswoman of the accused seeking to touch him with her tearful plea? Well, the heart here is as that piteous woman. The heart is the feminine in man, and hard though it be, she must here be ruled out. He paused, earnestly studying them for a moment, then resumed. But something in your aspect seems to urge that it is not solely that heart that moves in you, but also the conscience, the private conscience. But tell me whether or not, occupying the position we do, private conscience should not yield to that imperial one formulated in the code under which alone we officially proceed. Here the three men moved in their seats, less convinced than agitated by the course of an argument troubling but the more the spontaneous conflict within. Perceiving which, the speaker paused for a moment, then abruptly changing his tone, went on. To steady us a bit, let us recur to the facts. In wartime at sea, a man of war's man strikes his superior in grade, and the blow kills. Apart from its effect, the blow itself is, according to the Articles of War, a capital crime. Furthermore,
aye, sir, emotionally broke in an officer of marines. In one sense it was, but surely Bud purposed neither mutiny nor homicide.
Surely not, my good man. And before a court less arbitrary and more merciful than a martial one, that plea would largely extenuate. At the last assizes it shall acquit,
But how here? We proceed under the law of the Mutiny Act. In feature, no child can resemble his father more than that act resembles in spirit the thing from which it derives, war. In His Majesty's service, in this ship indeed, there are Englishmen forced to fight for the king against their will, against their conscience, for aught we know. Though, as their fellow creatures, some of us may appreciate their position, yet, as navy officers, what reck we of it? Still less recks the enemy. Our impressed men he would fain cut down in the same swath with our volunteers. As regards the enemy's naval conscripts, some of whom may even share our own abhorrence of the regicidal French directory, it is the same on our side. War but looks to the frontage, the appearance. And the Mutiny Act, war's child, takes after the father. Bud's intent or non-intent is nothing to the purpose. But while, put to it by those anxieties in you which I cannot but respect, I can only repeat myself, while thus strangely we prolong proceedings that should be summary. The enemy may be sighted, and an engagement result we must do, and one of two things must we do, condemn or let go. Can we not convict and yet mitigate the penalty? Asked the junior lieutenant, here speaking and falteringly for the first. Lieutenant, were that clearly lawful for us under the circumstances? Consider the consequences of such clemency. The people, meaning the ship's company, have native sense. Most of them are familiar with our naval usage and tradition. And how would they take it? Even could you explain to them, which our official position forbids, they, long molded by arbitrary discipline, have not that kind of intelligent responsiveness that might qualify them to comprehend and discriminate. No, to the people the foretopman's deed, however it be worded in the announcement, will be plain homicide committed in a flagrant act of mutiny. What penalty for that should follow, they know. But it does not follow. Why? They will ruminate. You know what sailors are. Will they not revert to the recent outbreak at the Nore? Aye, they know the well-founded alarm. A panic it struck throughout England. Your clement sentence they would account pusillanimous. They would think that we flinch, that we are afraid of them, afraid of practicing a lawful rigor singularly demanded at this juncture, lest it should provoke new troubles. What shame to us such a conjecture on their part, and how deadly to discipline. You see, then, whether prompted by duty and the law, I steadfastly drive. But I beseech you, my friends, do not take me amiss. I feel as you do for this unfortunate boy. But did he know our hearts, I take him to be of that generous nature that he would feel even for us on whom in this military necessity so heavy a compulsion is laid. With that, crossing the deck, he resumed his place by the sashed porthole, tacitly leaving the three to come to a decision. On the cabin's opposite side, the troubled court sat silent. Loyal lieges, plain and practical, though at bottom they dissented from some points Captain Vere had put to them, they were without the faculty, hardly had the inclination, to gainsay one whom they felt to be an earnest man, one, too, not less their superior in mind than in naval rank. But it is not improbable that even such of his words as were not without influence over them came home to them less than his closing appeal to their instinct as sea officers. He forecasted the practical consequences to discipline, considering the unconfirmed tone of the fleet at the time, if violent killing at sea by a man-of-war's man of a superior in grade were allowed to pass for aught else than a capital crime, and one demanding prompt infliction of the penalty. Not unlikely they were brought to something more or less akin to that harassed frame of mind which in the year 1842 actuated the commander of the U.S. Brig of War Somers to resolve, under the so-called Articles of War, articles modeled upon the English Mutiny Act, upon the execution at sea of a midshipman and two petty officers as mutineers designing the seizure of the brig. This resolution was carried out, though in a time of peace and within not many days' sail of home, and vindicated by a naval court of inquiry subsequently convened ashore. History, and here cited without comment. True, the circumstances on board the Somers were different from those on board the Indomitable, but the urgency felt, well warranted or otherwise, was much the same. Says a writer whom few know, 40 years after a battle,
It is easy for a non-combatant to reason about how it ought to have been fought. It is another thing, personally and under fire, to direct the fighting while involved in the obscuring smoke of it. Much so with respect to other emergencies involving considerations both practical and moral, and, when it is imperative, promptly to act. The greater the fog, the more it imperils the steamer, and speed is put on, though at the hazard of running somebody down. Little ween the snug card players in the cabin of the responsibilities of the sleepless man on the bridge. In brief, Billy Budd was formally convicted and sentenced to be hung at the yardarm in the early morning watch, it being now night. Otherwise, as is customary in such cases, the sentence would forthwith have been carried out. In wartime, on the field or in the fleet, a mortal punishment decreed by a drumhead court, on the field sometimes decreed by but a nod from the general, follows without delay on the heel of conviction without appeal.